Okay, welcome to the new neuroscience lecture series. It's my pleasure to introduce Nikos Logothetis. He's the director of the neurophysiology of cognitive processing laboratory at the Max Planck Institute, and most of you actually are probably aware of his work. He's been pioneering early on as a vision neuroscientist. He still does that. And he's been pioneering work in methodology development in electrophysiology. But also, I met him actually in the late 90s when we were going to the Max Planck to try to figure out what type of magnet to get for our monkey electrophysiology and fMRI work. And he's been pioneering that as well. That's where I know him. He's actually written a number of really seminal papers on understanding the relationship between neural activity and hemodynamic changes. And I think almost more than any other lab, he's actually shed light on understanding of this based on his work of doing simultaneous electrophysiologic recording with fMRI signals. So he has a very deep understanding, obviously, of what's really going on. Even though he's a director of this institute, he's extremely still hands-on and doing a lot of things himself. So his talk today is what is simulated during intercortical electrical stimulation. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you hear me, first of all? Can you hear me? No? Yes. I cannot put on my mustache. It hurts. Can you hear me now? Okay, thank you very much for the kind introduction and thank you for inviting me here. The aim of the talk, as you see from the title, is actually to talk about experiments that are done, combined experiments of electrical stimulation and neuroimaging, particularly fMRI. Now, what I want to do is I want to show you in the beginning very few slides that discuss the technology so you know basically the difficulties involved and all the methodological issues. And after these three or four slides, report to you the first published experiments on electrical stimulation of cortical areas in the visual system. And immediately after, go into the main part of the talk, which is basically an investigation of what's happening exactly if you stimulate the afferents of any cortical areas, whether or not the signals propagate normally, or there are certain problems that we should be all aware of, or even if there are tricks on the basis of which you can select pathways by applying the microstimulation technique. Now, unfortunately, I say that I'm not proud of it. I'm extremely bad in time management, but I can promise you I'll stop when you raise your hand and you tell me to stop. And in all cases, I promise you it won't last too long because tomorrow I'm leaving, so it's kind of a reasonably short talk. And here it is, the first slide. And the first question, of course, I can't see very much from here, but okay. The very first question is, why would you bother to do that? And there are many, many different reasons. You can come up with your own. I came up with a list of examples here. One very serious issue that I think a lot of people are interested in is the in vivo connectivity. It's more than ever clear now to everybody that by investigating a single spot in the brain, you won't go extremely far. These are organized, basically widespread systems, and it is very good if we know not only the properties of the local populations in a particular region of the brain, but also know the interconnectivity and the effective interconnectivity. The anatomic connectivity sometimes is massive, but doesn't mean you're using every single connection or every single synapse. And another thing is study of projective fields, and this is a concept that has been ignored for a long time, actually, because we have been concentrating on the properties of receptive fields, as you know. But there is more than receptive fields. Usually, the term projective field was introduced by Terry Sejnowski a few years ago. But this is something that everybody can feel. Not only you want to know how information is integrated in a particular recording site, but you want to know if you affect that particular recording site, what are the targets that see basically the results of what you have been doing. If the area is activated, what other areas see the signal, and what other areas process the signal that reaches them. Then, of course, is the open question that you know well, is the networks underlying electrostimulation-induced behaviors. I don't need to tell you there are many people in this room that I know very well. They have been using stimulation to study behavior. But on the other hand, all people know that when you have the behavior and you quantify it, you can quantify even the stimulation parameters, you still ignore many other steps that are happening in the entire organized system that might be of particular interest. Then, of course, is network plasticity. If I have any time in the end, which I kind of doubt, but I'll show you one or two slides where you see basically, for example, LTP-induced global changes in the brain or kindling-induced global changes. Very interesting because it shows basically something that you could not see with single electrode recording techniques or even with other methodologies that have a limited scope. So finally, if you care, and probably at NIH you do, you can gain a lot of insights regarding the mechanisms of electrotherapy, and of course, you can design much better neural prosthetic systems if you know how signals propagate correctly, because after all, the systems, they are supposed to use some electrically induced activity. Now, of course, like anything else, it's not only the good things, but there are also some problems. And the first problems are pure scientific, neuroscientific, if you want, and conceptual. They are basically, I'm just giving again three examples. We do not know what is stimulated when we pass current in the tissue. And this has been very nicely actually phrased by James Strunk in 1975 in a not-to-miss review, where he said that electrical stimulation of the lateral hypothalamus, for example, is a shortened version of the statement that there was a stimulating electrode in the lateral hypothalamus which affected an unknown number and unknown kinds of cells at unknown locations in the vicinity of the electrode. This is tragically true. We still don't know exactly, with all the diversity we have, the differences in membrane constants, the differences in what you would call the anodal blocks that I'm going to show you in a second. We don't really 100% know what is going to be stimulated and whether it's repeatable and it's consistent, let alone whether there is a very meaningful variability from area to area that can tell us something about function. Now, there are things like how does the signal... Okay, how does the signal propagate? You stimulate and something is going. Usually you can manage to stimulate axons. You can ensure that the signal is going to go away from wherever the site is that you're stimulating. But where does it go and how is it processed? And what the neural circuits are that are activated at the projection sites? Who are you activating? Inputs, the whole system, you're blocking the input, the output, what do you do exactly? Now, these kind of the last questions, I think, can benefit enormously by the electrostimulation combined with fMRI because you can get a global view of the whole system at work. Now, there are, of course, also methodological problems, not only conceptual problems. One of them is that you need a MAR-compatible hardware. I won't go into any of the details. I only mention things, and I'll give you a few examples that are characteristics one could easily miss while starting this kind of work. So you have to develop the drives, the coils, everything that you need to do that correctly. You need accurate delivery of pulses. That's actually quite a bit of an issue because if you want to do excitability measurements, if you want to know exactly what's the nature of the neural elements that has been stimulated, you need to have constant pulses, and these constant pulses can be given only if you have no filtering and distortions that are introduced by the different transport systems. In this case, let's say, the cables that you are using, and in the magnet you use long cables. If the desired pulse is the one that you see with the green curve here, the one that you really pass, if you don't do anything and any correction, is the blue. So basically, there's absolutely no way you do quantitative estimates of, let's say, chronaxy or Rho base or all these parameters or passive current spread if you think you're giving this signal and actually you're giving this signal. Here, with automatic cable capacitance compensation, you get this red signal that approximates the green, and there are better methods now. You can even go closer to the theoretically, basically, intended signal that to be passed to the tissues. Then you have a correct selection of electrodes, quite a big issue, as you're going to see in a second, and aim-directed stimulation protocols. They may differ according to what kind of expect, what is your expectations from, what is the anatomical, basically, knowledge regarding the stimulated site. And finally, there is systematic assessment of current spread and neural excitability that is not an option. It's almost a requirement for most of the experiments that want to have some quantitative claims. Okay, the electrode materials, as I said, is important. Don't worry, this is the one before the last slide, and we are done with anything that relates to techniques. But I wanted to alert at least the people that are interested basically in using microstimulation in the magnet. For the purpose we want to use the microstimulation, what we really, really want to know is charge density and current density rather than current intensity itself. That's usually the value that you're getting in most of the published papers. And much less, of course, voltage. Voltages are quite useless, and I don't understand even why people bother to report them, because as you may know, most of the voltage drops, they occur at the interface of electrode to the tissue. So basically, it's not telling you anything about the real gradient of voltage that is the driving, basically, force for the depolarization of the neurons. So that means if you want to know what is happening in the extracellular space, you need to know currents. But if you have also the fMRI that might require a larger amount of currents to activate larger populations, then you need to have a lot of current, but possibly with relatively low current density or charge density to avoid damaging the tissue. So there are a lot of conflicting things, but fortunately they are manageable. You can do it. And here's a description, basically, of these parameters that are not just theoretical things, but they're real things. You can get the charge density by having, basically, the Q, by having the charge, and by having the area. And that area you can measure by having very consistent fabrication of your electrodes, or alternatively, you can estimate it, as most people do, by using this formula that was introduced in 1983. By Lemon. And with this formula here, you can get an idea on the basis of the impedance of your electrode, if you're using always the same, basically, geometry of electrodes. From the impedance, you get an idea of the surface, but this surface, remember, is geometrical surface. So it has an implication. It means you are not supposed to have your electrodes corrode, because if you cause corrosion, you enormously increase the surface, and you change also the impedance. Basically, your values do not hold anymore. So our first thing was basically to have a plot. You see a three-dimensional color-coded plot where you have the charge density as a function of the current intensity and electrode impedance. And these are the two typical electrodes you may know. You can add also the 7030 that we often use for physiology. And if you see the corrosion lines here, you'll see that the iridium is much better off, despite of the fact that it has probably one voxel more or two voxels more susceptibility artifacts. So what we try to do to avoid any changes during the microstimulation, we use for quantitative analysis only the microstimulation sites where the parameters made basically the charge density be underneath this iridium corrosion line. Finally, an important issue because of the diversity of the anatomical, let's say, anatomical substrate of each one of the areas that you record is whether your electrode is going to be monopolar, bipolar. The bipolar electrodes, for those that are interested, are very good because they tend actually not to generate very, very large shock artifacts, but on the other hand are the ones that are not understood. They are very poorly understood. All the studies, everything that you might want to consult in the literature that gives you values about stimulation parameters are based on monopolar electrodes, because the electric fields, from a pure physics point of view, can be described much easier with monopolar than with the bipolar electrodes. So you use different types also of pulse sequences, symmetric biphasic, narrow band sync pulses, sweeps, and all these kind of things. And the reason for that is if you get strange, basically, results, you want to make sure that these results were not the result of a poor methodology. So that much about the methodology, and we go now to the real results. We collected our data with two systems. We've had for the last 10 years or so two systems. The one is a 4.7 Tesla system that is equipped with, if I remember correctly, 50 millitesla per meter, basically, gradients. And the most interesting part of the systems is they are locally shielded, and they permit, they are fine-tuned, they permit simultaneous, basically, invasive measurements and in neuroimaging. So not much different from what you have here. And the other is 7 Tesla and 60 centimeters that is used both for spectroscopy and for the alert behaving animal, because we need more space. Now for that here, actually, I think, I remember that I suggested very strongly to Bob Decimo before he left to not buy this system, but to buy the 4.7, which Leopold has in his laboratory now. That was definitely a better choice, I can tell you, because the problems that you get with interference with this system are immense, and it forced us to do 10 times more work than we are supposed to. Anyway, now things work, but the 4.7 Tesla 60 centimeters, the magnet that you have, and CaltechBot, I think, is an excellent selection for the kind of multimodal experiments that you want to do. And you see results now. You have another couple of slides where I'm going to be showing to you some preliminary results that were published a couple of years ago in Neuron and in the magnetic resonance imaging that show basically, first of all, the feasibility of the technique. The electrode is where the tip of this arrow is, and if you microstimulate here with the parameters you see here in red, then you get activation, and you may well see that this activation is, of course, in V1, the area that you stimulate, in the primary visual cortex of the monkeys, but it's also in the posterior bang of the lunate sulcus. This is the area V2. for those that are not, all this V1, V2 for those that happen not to be in vision, which is difficult nowadays in neuroscience because I think everybody does something with vision. But anyway, for those that are, this is the second, it's like a visual association area, receives information from V1 and has relatively similar properties but not identical properties to this first primary visual cortex. And then information goes also to the posterior bank of the superior temporal sulcus. This is what you see here. And this is the area V5 or area MT that is also visual air. Most of the neurons of which happen to be very sensitive to moving stimuli. Now, if you stimulate here, the V2 receives information from V1, and you see activation of V2, and the area MT or V5 receives information from V1, and you see activation of MT as well, and of course you see activation of many other things that are not included in this particular slice. If you examine the time courses of these bold activations, they look quite normal. They look like the ones you would get with basically with a visual stimulus. So there is no difference between having a small visual stimulus that is presented in a way that excites the stimulate, electrically stimulated area, and the responses that you get when you pass a current in this particular area. Now, that's good, and it tells you that basically many of the technical problems are solved and you can start working. But there are, of course, couple of things that we wanted to check before we start the main part of the work. The relationship of all these things to the known results from physiology and some results from behavioral studies. And in particular, we wanted to know what is the effective current spread. How much of what you see here as activation because you stimulate one point is because there is a spread of the current that would excite certain neurons at a particular distance from the tip of the electrode, and how much of it is because Bolt might be showing much more than what you would expect, that it's very sensitive, or you stimulate vessels, or you do something funny in all cases that you get this activation, but it does not correspond to the underlying stimulated neural population. And the second thing that's even better in characterizing the kind of response you get is what you would call excitability properties, and I'll come back to that in about a second. So, to see the spread in a qualitative way, you only need to have multiple slice acquisition. There's typical ecoplanar imaging here, and you see the threshold that maps, the T-score maps, basically, that are superimposed on the anatomy. And you see that basically there's a spread in the horizontal plane, and of course there is this plane in the dorsal ventral direction. And if you render the whole brain, these are the slices here that you see basically as horizontal slices, then you get this spread of activation here. And the idea is now how much of it is due to real, basically, excitation of the neuronal population that in that part of the cortex. You can get an idea by consulting, first of all, physiology. I'm only mentioning that for completeness. This is some kind of review that I have done from reviews and original papers, where basically I plot for you the distance in micrometers from the tip of the electrode as a function of the current in microamps. And you see there are different lines with different shapes and different colors, and these are for different types of elements. These are here cell bodies, the patterned lines, and these very thin ones here are unmyelinated fibers, and these are myelinated passing fibers, and so on and so forth. What does that tell you? That tells you that for each one of the currents you're going to be using, after choosing a particular duration of the microstimulation, pulse duration, here is 200 microseconds, which is pretty standard in the literature, you will have the excitation of different elements, and these elements are diverse in nature, and of course they are distributed in different ways in space. So if you select basically 100 micrometers pulse, then you know that you're going to be exciting some of the large myelinated, up to 1200 micrometers axons, some large cells, small myelinated, and so on and so forth. And on top of it, you know that this is going to be a shell. It is not a compact set. It's not a sphere, but a shell. Because if you have a spread of the field like that, and you keep injecting currents here, and these currents become large enough to achieve the purpose you want, you're going to get a hole here, not because you damage the tissue, but because you have the famous anodal surround effect that was basically already reported by Hodgkin and Huxley in their initial experiments, the depolarization is here so strong that the spread hyperpolarizations along the axon tends to be strong enough to block basically the spikes. That means, despite of the fact we are stimulating here, some things that are nearby the tip of the electrode, they won't be stimulated, and other things that are a little farther and they get a little better, basically, distribution of currents, they will be appropriately stimulated. Now, you might be wondering why I bother to tell you all these things, because you're going to hear some strange results. And a very good way to try to understand these results is to understand also the underlying complications. Whether or not I'll be able actually to pass my message is a different story, depending on how good speaker I am. But basically, what I'm trying to tell you is something you would need to see basically the quantitative data that I'll present you in the second half of the talk. So this is the anodal, and this shows you basically which kind of elements you might be and where you might be stimulating. So if you increase, basically you're going to get a failure here, and this is not because of susceptibility artifact, because the moment you decrease the current, you'll see again basically the activation in the middle. So we did these measurements. We measured very carefully because we wanted to make sure that we are activating certain types of neural elements. They are in a certain extent, and they don't basically spread all over the place. And we wanted to know how that compares with the physiological measurements that we knew from many years of electrophysiology combined with stimulation. And what you can see here, if you have different basic currents that go from 159 to almost 1650 microamps, in the beginning, there is an increase in the volume, or in the surface, basically, the volume that you are exciting, and then there is a saturation. At some point, you can go to very high currents without damaging the tissue because, as I said, of the appropriate charge or current density, and there is no more increase. There is that much you can stimulate by stimulating one particular point. 40% of this maximal increase has been the threshold for all the measurements that we did in the next slides, in the next one, two slides. So when we did that, we compared basically the distance from the electrode that we get with respect to the one that was described many years ago by Stoney, who measured actually the current spread in the primary visual cortex of primates, and he described it with this equation. In general, the spread is nothing else but the square root of the current intensity divided by the square root of this k, which happens to be the excitability constant. Now, according to this line, in cortex, in this animal, you would expect actually these currents to generate activation that is around this line here, the dotted line, and not here. This additional offset that you see by 2 or 2.5 millimeters is due, as we said several times, to this sub-threshold activation of the nearby columns that happen to be interconnected with the horizontal connections. Finally, to ensure that we are indeed stimulating pyramidal cells, in this case is in our interest because we want the signal to go from where we are somewhere else, we did a complete analysis of excitability by getting the strength duration curves. You see them here. What that tells you is if you play, there's a trade-off between the pulse duration and the intensity of the current. If you see the relationship of current intensity and pulse duration that happens to cause exactly the same response, you get the so-called basically strength duration curves like the ones you see here. And these strength duration curves are nothing else but basically doing the following experiment. You start with a particular pulse duration that is long, and you increase the intensity, you get a response curve of how many voxels, in this case with MRI, you are activating. And then you reduce basically, and this is going to be shifted as expected to the right because you need now more current because it's a shorter pulse, and then again to the right. And if you have a threshold, and as I told you, this threshold is 40% of the maximum possible volume, then that threshold permits basically the plotting of these values against these values here. You get this curve. Now, this curve might look in the beginning not so interesting one, but it is actually because it's a signature for the stimulated elements. The asymptotic level here is called the Rio base, and it tells you basically that if you make a pulse very long, you cannot make it any longer and reduce more the current. No matter what you do with the current, basically this is the pulse duration is not going to change the results. This is called the Rio base, and this Rio base, two times its value, gives you this magic number, Cronach-C, that directly tells you something about the membrane constant of the stimulated elements. That's the main point. And this is very characteristic for motor neurons, for sensory neurons, pain axons, cardiac muscles, smooth muscle, and so on and so forth. That means you get a good, very good idea of whether or not in your experiment you are stimulating basically, mostly, not exclusively, axons, large cells, small cells, or very, very small cells. And in our experiments, it turned out basically with the parameters we use, they were likely to stimulate large cells. Although if you play with pulse duration, you can also achieve the stimulation of smaller neurons the way they did in stimulation of the thalamus. So that's it with all the preliminary experiments. And the results that we got is that fMRI-based measurements, for those that are interested in the technology, yield estimates of current spread and excitability that are entirely comparable with those obtained with physiological and behavioral methods. On the basis of RioBase and Cronach-C measurements, cortical electrostimulation with the commonly used parameters excite large pyramidal cells, keep this in mind, and cell bodies. Now, cortical electrostimulation, as I showed you, activate. I did not show you basically repetition of these experiments with other visual areas, but the result is basically the same. And you can say that cortical electrostimulation activates reliably all monosynaptic targets of the stimulated area. However, strangely enough, and that kept me busy for the last 2 years personally, no transsynaptic activation was observed in all the pilot experiments. Several experiments, several animals, several areas could not get a transsynaptic activation. The signal basically would go to the first synaptic target and would stop there. And the question basically I wanted to ask, and this is going to be for the rest of the talk, is can an ES-induced excitation of cortical efferents propagate in cortex? Now the answer, which is also the main point of the talk, after that you'll know it, is in two slides. First, I want to remind those of you that are not familiar with thalamocortical circuitry that from the eye you go to different areas, to colliculus, you go to pulvinar, of course, mainly you go to LGN, and from LGN you go to cortex, and there is a little bit of a myth, once you go to cortex, you stay there and you do nothing else. That's not exactly true, but we'll assume that we buy it for the beginning, and so you go to LGN, you go to V1, and from V1 you go to the rest of the world. The subdivisions, the histochemical subdivision of all the structures that this information is diverse. That's why I have a very simplified version that says basically you have just colliculus, pulvinar, LGN. And if you want to activate the efferents of cortex and have a clear idea of whether or not then cortico-cortical interaction is going to occur, you can stimulate any of these locations. Either you can stimulate basically the optic tract, or you can stimulate the optic nerve, the optic tract, or the LGN, or you can stimulate the efferents of the optical radiation. We chose to do everything, and I'll tell you the results of LGN, and then I'll make a simple comment as to how it looks if you stimulate one of the other areas. Now, the result, you see that visual stimulation is going to give you a very robust whole visual field stimulation response that we've known for the last 10 years. We kept repeating these kind of experiments. And if you have electrical stimulation, of course, you'll get a limited, fortunately, because the stimulation of LGN, in this case, I think the electrode is exactly here. It basically communicates with this portion of the primary visual cortex, and this is the portion you'll see activated. The result that made us actually very curious, I forgot to connect. Is there any audio here? If there is not, forget it. Try to hear it from here. See, here, I would like you to pay attention because that's the whole message of the talk here. See what's happening here when you stimulate. This is the primary visual cortex. It's the V1 that you see here, and this is the area V2. And if you flash the visual stimulus, of course, both V1 and V2 are activated. See now what's going to happen when you have the electrical stimulus, which is the second bar here. Do you see what's happening? Anybody notice anything strange? Because I think that's the message of the talk, so it's better if you see it yourself. So it repeats with the visual activation of V1 here, activation of V2. You see from the bar here that red is activation or yellow, and green is basically inhibition or deactivation. So let's see now what happens with electrical stimulus. Activation of V1, you see what's happening in V2? It goes down. Weird, right? So why? Because we use stimulation. We have been all using the stimulation, and we stimulate the cortex, and we think basically you have a chain of events, and this chain of events, because it gives a behavioral result, is supposed to be a propagation of the activation. But that's not what you see here. So the question is why? And the result is quite dramatic. If you render basically the activated brain, you'll see that the stimulation of LGN, it will cause activation here in the primary visual cortex, some activation in the MTEM that we'll talk about in a second, and then a lot of all the rest of the extrastriate cortex is going to show a very profound, basically, drop of activity with respect to the baseline. So the rest of the talk tries to understand why this is happening. So that's basically the message. Those of you that are busy, that's it. Okay, let's go to this a little more carefully now. This is the electrode. This is the lateral geniculate body. I suppose I do not, in this audience, need to tell what the lateral geniculate body is. Yes or no? No. Okay. So this is the part of the visual thalamus, and you go with your electrode there, and what you see here is basically the colliculus, and this here is the pulvinar, this here is the pulvinar, and you see also the different, basically, visual areas. And you stimulate, and if you stimulate the LGN, of course you have an increase of activity in the LGN that induces a very robust and repeatable hemodynamic response. That's the bold response that you have here in LGN. Now, if you see what happens in the rest of the brain, you'll see you get a very good positive response also in the pulvinar, and a very good response also in the colliculus and also in the pulvinar. Now, neither of these two responses are obvious for reasons that we might want to discuss later on, based on the known anatomical connectivity. But anyway, if you go to V1, as you expect, because you stimulated the axons, as I told you, of the lateral geniculate body, there is a signal that is incoming in the area V1, in the primary visual cortex, and it generates a very strong positive response. And then what happens in the extrastriate cortex? All the extrastriate cortex, as you show in the movie, is basically inhibited. The activity of each one of the areas drops below the normal level that you would have without any stimulus. Keep this in mind. This is what I mean, inhibition. It's basically deactivation, I should call it, because I'm not talking about chemically mediated inhibition. Okay? So here is two sessions, and for these two sessions, the results, I think, are extremely clear. In the lateral geniculate body, there's an increase of bold in colliculus, increase of bold in pulvinar, increase of bold in primary visual cortex, very strong decreases in the area MT, in the area V2, in the area MT, and XC means basically extrastriate cortex because there was no space in the graph to start putting each one of the areas. So basically the whole extrastriate cortex, V2, V3, V4, and so on, beyond V2 is dropping below the spontaneous activity level. Now, something to be careful about here is that we have long described, this was published some years ago, one year ago in Nature Neuroscience by Amir. We describe this negative bold. When you present a stimulus that is limited in space, very often you have these areas that show a drop in the signal. The negative bold that meanwhile has been described by different people in different systems and under different conditions and verified also with optical imaging studies and with combined technologies using basically Doppler flow and all these things. Now you have this negative bold, and definitely you do not want to have this negative bold confusing these results that I'm presenting you in any possible case. So what we have done for further analysis and quantitative analysis, we used a mixed design where you have a visual stimulation within the single observation period, followed by electrical stimulation in any random order, in an event-related design, or a combined design where you have basically a visual stimulus, you add on top of it an electrical stimulus, and then you remove the electrical stimulus, you just only have basically the visual stimulus remaining. Now, what happens if you go to subcortical areas or you go to the area V1? What happens is the visual stimulus is going to cause an increase in bold, as you would expect, and the electrical stimulus is going to, of course, cause an increase in bold. You'll see that in LGN, in the subcortical structures, and you'll see it also in the area V1. If you go to area V2, or as a matter of fact, in any of the extrastriate areas, you'll see this funny thing that you saw already in the movie, but now you know that it's coming for the areas normally activated by the stimulus and not from the negative bolt areas. There is a positive increase in the bolt when you have the visual stimulus, and the moment you have the electrical stimulus, there is a drop. If you have them combined in the primary visual cortex and in the subcortical areas, you have basically this extra increase because you add up the electrical stimulus. And if you go to extrastriate cortex, during the application of the electrical stimulus, you'll have a very strong decrease of the signal that goes still even beyond the baseline. This summarizes the results for you. And you see that overall, in many, many experiments, I haven't counted them yet, the paper is in writing, but something like, I think, 10 animals in over 22 sessions, this is the average of responses, and you'll see that the LGN is basically excited, you stimulate it, the colliculus is excited, pulvinar is excited when you stimulate the LGN, and then the one, in very few cases, that were useful, but not the origin of which it's not clear. There was an inhibition, but about 98% of the cases, basically, there is an excitation in V1, the same thing approximately in V2, and MT is about 50-50. Now, that's interesting because when we went basically indeed a posteriori the analysis, we noticed that the cases that show basically an inhibition of MT are the cases where we stimulate axons because of the used values. The cases where you see an excitation of MT is when you use very long pulse durations and very low intensity, which means probably you activate the corneocellular system that gives a direct input to the area V5 or area MT. So this is why the responses here are split. Now, why all this is happening? And what does the physiology say? Well, you probably would agree that things in cortex are a little more difficult than what we usually assume by simply, you know, assuming that an input is converging, it has a certain geometrical convergence pattern, and this is giving the properties of the next neuron, and this neuron fires if you present an oriented line. In the reality, things are a little more complicated. The thalamic input actually is very, very weak. And it does not go, although it goes primarily to the layer 4, it does not go exclusively to the layer 4. In fact, we have more than enough evidence from several laboratories that show that the thalamic input that is not more than 10 or 15% of the entire cortical input at any given site, it goes simultaneously to the subgranular, to supragranular and subgranular, infragranular, basically, excitatory neurons, glutamatergic neurons, and it goes also to the GABAergic cells. So these are separated here only because of their special sensitivity to different type of agonists and antagonists, so we don't want to go through that. But once these neurons are stimulated, there is a very antagonistic relationship between the groups where there is both basically recurrent excitation and there is also recurrent inhibition. And the recurrent excitation is very strong, in particular in the classes of the pyramidal cells. So this is basically here a catastrophic loop because it's a positive feedback loop, and you would expect in a system that is not perfectly controlled a runaway excitation, basically an epileptic fit within very few hundreds of milliseconds. But you do not, and the reason you do not is because these pyramidal cells, as the drawing implies, they are interdigitated with very strategically located inhibitory neurons that, although they are 15 to 20% of all the neurons in cortex, they target literally strategical positions in the pyramidal cells, and they can stop the inhibition at different levels. Later in the whole recurrence, or very much in the beginning, and this is not a speculation, I'm just basically giving you a 30 seconds review of what we know from the literature regarding the cortical microcircuits. The properties are summarized here. Weak feed-forward inhibition, recurrence at very strong, long excitation inhibition evolution that goes beyond simple synaptic events. It lasts, as you can see, for 200 or 150 or 300 milliseconds. And finally, an inseparability, because every single neuron, if you record intracellularly, appears to receive at any given time both the excitation and immediately after the inhibition. So you have a circuit, basically, that can only operate and give a reasonable output, the expected output, if you respect the synaptic delays. So if you manage actually to block by activating all the inhibition with a simultaneous pulse, the way we do with electrical stimulation, I assume you should not be surprised that the system's output shuts down, and we think this is exactly what is happening, and you're going to see it here with the physiology we have done. This physiology is with multiple electrodes. It shows an LGN, basically receptive fields, and it shows the receptive fields of different neurons in cortex. And here's what happens if you stimulate. You stimulate at the point of the red arrow, and as you see, immediately after the stimulation, after the removal of the artifact, you have a huge gap. It can be up to 100 or sometimes even longer milliseconds period that there is no activation at all. Basically, you have the first spike that is coming from the stellates that receive the thalamic, is basically the thalamocortical synapse. And immediately after that, there is basically nothing, and there is a rebound. And after this rebound, you have the continuing activity as a response to any particular stimulus. This gap depends on the distance from the site of the LGN, basically from the site that is being stimulated through the LGN electrode. So you see in some cases it's very large, in some cases small, in some cases, in the case of the receptive field here, it's very far from the LGN site, it doesn't work at all. So that means basically, if you stimulate the thalamus, and there are people, as you may know, that they want to stimulate the thalamus with prosthetic devices, then what you should expect is that the V1 itself, it will appear as activated in the MRI because it receives input and there is activation of the thalamocortical synapses, but the output of V1, which in fact is the output of all the microcircuits, it's going to go down to zero. Now, someone here who might be familiar with the literature can tell us, is this new? Actually not, but I'm surprised sometimes how differently you read the literature that you know if you have a personal experience with something. So, and what you can see here, there is a study that's almost 20-something years old. This is by Kevin Martin and by Ron Douglas with intracellular recordings in the primary visual cortex of the cat, where basically they record intracellularly while they stimulate the afferents. And see what's happening. You stimulate here, and after you stimulate, you get a very brief depolarization. Immediately after, as I told you, in an inseparable way, you have a very strong deactivation inhibition that we now know is induced by the GABA-A receptor. Following this GABA-A receptor-induced inhibition, you have a very long-lasting one of hyperpolarization, and this is induced by the GABA-B receptor. So basically, during this period, if you have any stimulus coming in, it's not likely to be processed. And you can see here with the diagram, the moment you stimulate the LGN, you activate the synapse, the stellate neuron, but the pyramidal cell output basically shuts down. Now, interestingly enough, this did not go unnoticed from different investigators. You see the work here by Clay Reed and by David Ferster and other investigators that they were trying to understand the physiological properties of the very, very first neurons in cortex to see whether the stellate cells are basically orientation selective. And the reason they wanted to do that, they wanted to see whether the initial suggestion of Hubel and Wiesel that basically the selectivity in the primary visual cortex is a result of the organization of the synaptic inputs is true. And sure enough, by applying these pulses, you see that after you apply a 5 microamps pulse, you lose a lot of the activation that's induced by a stimulus that is just sub-threshold. And if you apply 50 microamps, there is not a single spike. So if you show basically that the single spike they're going to get from the stellate cell, it depends on the orientation. It is a way to show that basically the orientation selectivity is established already after the first thalamocortical synapse, and the rest of the circuitry probably elaborates more this selectivity. So the point here in my talk is that we have known these things, but I do not know, and I do not know of anybody who actually thought of the implications of all these individual experiments and all these individual, observations to the propagation of signals during electrical stimulation. So with what I told you then, if you have three imaginary areas, let's say also in cortex, you stimulate the area A, and if you stimulate the area A, you know that you stimulate, as I told you in the beginning, the pyramidal cells and the pyramidal axons, and you go to area B, And then you would expect normally from area B the signal to propagate and go to area C. And imagine also that this here, this circuitry has also this cortical, subcortical, cortical loop through, let's say, a higher association nucleus like the pulvinar, for example, in thalamus. Now, if you do that, what you really get, the signal goes away from here indeed. It reaches the area B, you can call it anything you want, but the output of B now shuts down. So the area C now, if it sees any signal, this signal is through this cortical subcortical loop, which in some cases is insufficient to generate with imaging a positive bulb response, and in some other cases it might be, particularly when we have the alert animal where the pulvinar is doing something more substantial than it does in the anesthetized preparation. So if all this is true and it's not fantasy, then one might ask the question, so what happens if we inactivate basically the inhibition? So if we basically cancel the inhibition, would then the signal propagate? And how would you do it? You would probably do it very well by having injections that are done at the very same time with electrical stimulation. To do that, since about 4 or 5 years ago, actually before we started this project, we have been developing a system with which you can do very precise measurements. You can inject something and also know exactly how much you injected. It's done with a triple-barrel glass, and it has basically some HPLP pumps that are very accurate, and has also flow measurements, so you know exactly, quite exactly what you injected. And also, then you have electrodes at the very same time, and you can record the activity. So the pilot studies to estimate optimal spread was in vivo experiments and flow and volume parameters adjustments and MRI experiments in monkeys with gadolinium. You see an example here that makes it very clear that you can have sessions with no good results, not because the substance doesn't work consistently, but because your injection method does not work appropriately. Look what is happening here if you inject with appropriate flow parameters. I have no time to tell you details, but you see what's happening basically. The whole injection, in this case the injection was lidocaine together with mixed with gadolinium, so you can visualize it with MRI. It goes to the sub-PL space, and it does not really go into the cortex where you want it to go. And here's what happened with an appropriate control of parameters. You see basically that the whole substance is going, now you know you're going to have an effect. And when you get this kind of performance, then you can do basically an analysis of the behavior of the circuitry during the stimulation conditions. So that's what we have done. First, we tested with lidocaine. There is a very clear cessation of the activity, of the neural activity, and there is a very clear, basically, so to speak, drop of the bolt signal after both the spikes and the LFPs and the bolt signal. And most importantly, this modulation, whether you use conventional general linear model analysis or you use ICA, independent component analysis, something that's not supervised, it permits in all cases a very, very good delineation of the affected area. The blue here is the affected area, so you can get an estimate of what area basically received the substance that you have injected. And if you compare this area that you estimate with physiological, with basically the fMRI analysis, with the area that you get from the gadolinium injections that I showed you previously, they're basically almost identical. So we know that to some extent we control the so-called injection region of interest, the injection ROI. So the injected drugs that we have were basically GABA-A blockers. You know very well the bicuculin here. It's known to everybody. And there is this other agent that's a new agent, the CGB46381, which is a very good GABA-B blocker. And we wanted to see whether either one of them or the combination of them, it's going to give us basically a change in the propagation of the signals. I'm only remind you here basically that even in the periphery here up, you can have the area V2 because the area V2, the primary visual cortex, folds in from all directions. So the area I'm going to show you, this is just to remind you here and here, is the area V2. I have it here in the circles. And this is the upper slice that the number slice number 5 or something like that you will examine in detail. Now, this is our estimate of the region of the injection. And the first thing we wanted to see is how the raw signal without any processing looks in this particular area. And sure enough, if you see the signal, there's a change in the baseline because of the lack of inhibition. You have a lot of activity. A lot of neurons are active. The baseline of BALD changes, as you see here. And also the stimulus-induced modulation becomes larger. If you now want to go and select basically the areas that have been directly affected in terms of increases in modulation, the first thing you have to do is to generate what you would call some kind of mask for the activated areas before you start the injection. The reason for that is without using this recursive, inclusive, general linear model analysis, it's impossible actually to tell when A is higher than B. You cannot tell whether B was positive and smaller or it was even negative. So to make sure that we are getting the activated areas before the injection, you first generate a mask of all the areas that showed basically a positive signal during the stimulation before you inject the electrical stimulation, before you inject anything. If you then get a mask and you say, now I want to know basically all those areas that happen to have more signal than they had before the stimulation, then you see a clear increase in the modulation. And the areas that do that are the red areas that you see within the suspected region of interest, plus minus something. And these are basically some voxels that appear not to be doing anything for whatever reasons. Now we go to the real thing. We want to investigate what happens in the injection recipient area. Basically, if you have lowered the inhibition in one particular area, you want to see what happens to the signal in the area that was receiving information from the area that has decreased inhibition. So we select all the negative areas that show basically inhibition. And then we select in those negative areas that are after negative, basically before the injection, we select the ones that happen to have basically negative before the injection and positive after the injection. And you see that there is one particular area here close to the injection site that shows this red. And you can better understand the change if you track the correlation coefficient with respect to the microstimulation. There is a negative correlation coefficient, which means for every stimulation you cause basically a reduction of the BALD signal. And after the injections that is here depicted by the green line, you have a positive correlation coefficient. So here, if we zoom in into this particular area that receives information from the injected area, there is a very clear negative BALD here, before you do the injection, because of this recurrent circuitry, and after you do the injection, it becomes positive with a very strong positive response, which means the signal now propagates, provided you don't have the very strong inhibitory action of the two types of A and B GABA receptors. And here's another animal to show you that this is basically something you can get now systematically by doing the appropriate injections and stimulation. In the last few minutes, I want to ask the question, okay, what happens if you stimulate other structures that don't necessarily have this serial relationship with respect to, they don't have this hierarchical processing that you see with LGN, V1, V2, and so on. So one of the very, very obvious areas to stimulate is the pulvinar. As you may know, the whole sheet of the neocortex is mapped onto the, there are two maps basically, very precise. If you go to the, let's say caudal, if you go to medial lateral medial lateral direction of the pulvinar, you'll see basically that you have the temporal and cingulate and vice versa. And this is a one-to-one map from each one of the areas with the following interesting thing. If you go from the retina to LGN and then you go to V1, the one we know, then we assume that the information from the upper layers is going to go to area V2. But we usually forget, although some people don't forget it at all, for example, Murray Sherman and Tillery and others, there is a very strong driver projection that goes to basically ionotropic receptors in this pulvinar nucleus in the thalamus that goes from layer 5 to the pulvinar, and then it goes to the layer basically 4, to the input layers of the next area. And what I think is quite spectacular is that if two cortical areas communicate directly, like the V1 and V2, they are likely to have overlapping thalamic fields. If not, their thalamic fields avoid each other. They are totally separate or they're interdigitating. So that means for every interconnected area that you have a cortical-cortical connection, you expect from the existing, basically, anatomy to have also a cortico-pulvinar, in this case for the visual system, cortical connection. Now, if you stimulate then the pulvinar, you have a parallel system of driver main connections that go from pulvinar to the area V1, V2, and so on. And sure enough, in this case, you see that there's no problem. You go again to the thalamus, you stimulate. In every single area that you measure the bolt, you have basically a positive increase in the signal. And that summarizes the pulvinar results. You see that activation of the pulvinar will make red the whole surface here, and activation of LGN, of colliculus, of pulvinar, V1, and so on and so forth. So, the last thing I want to ask you is, why is it we see colliculus and pulvinar activated while we stimulate the LGN? You might remember that if you stimulate the LGN, you see both these centers activated. And if you remember the anatomical connectivity, the colliculus has a very clear projection to LGN, to specific layers, but there is no known projection, at least to the best of my knowledge, from LGN to colliculus. So if you stimulate the LGN, you might think that you may be seeing antidromic stimulation, but that is not something you can see with imaging. We know from Louis Sokolov's work, we know from our work, we know from work for different people, that if synaptic transmission is not involved, you just don't see activation, period. So by activating this, you're not going to see anything here. So there is another possibility, of course, that you activate... you go anterograde, and because there are bifurcations and branches in the optical nerve and optical tract, you go back and then you go forwards again, you go to colliculus, but there would be a very small signal, and so small signal that I don't know you would be able to see. Finally, there is a possibility that when you activate LGN, you do go to V1, and because many of the deep layer neurons, they do not contribute largely into this microcircuitry, you see immediate activity of them that is from cortical subcortical connectivity that activate the colliculus. So you remember here I told you that V1 had a few cases where there is no activation of V1 at all. We checked what is happening under these conditions, and sure enough, every time you lose V1, you definitely lose the superior colliculus and the pulvinar. Finally, these experiments are very well actually visible in the anesthetized monkey because you see the V1 under feed-forward processing mode. So, but they are not exclusive to anesthetized monkey. You get the same exactly problem with the alert monkey except that there is no actually change in the baseline. You don't see propagation of the signal, but there is no change in the baseline of extrastriatal cortex for the simple reason that the input from all the higher areas, probably large enough not to make it possible to see small differences. So the conclusions are the unnatural and highly synchronized excitation of cortical afferents likely activates simultaneously both excitatory and inhibitory recurrent pathways that shunt the spiking of projection neurons. Shunting is mainly due to the spatial uniformity of the activation profile, then the stimulation intensity itself. It may work with all kinds of different intensities. If so, then electrostimulation as well as the transmagnetic stimulation, transcranial stimulation, most likely silence all cortical areas receiving input from the fibers they excite. Then the results of electrostimulation and TMS need to be interpreted as showing A, what an area does by itself together with all its subcortical projections, it's possible, or what kind of behaviors follow the reduction of activity of a monosynaptic target from the stimulated region. So I think I'm running out of time, and I won't tell you the few more things I wanted about BOLD and the consequences, and I'll stop here. Thank you.
Anybody awake?
Oh, yes.
So just to recap, you told us that
Correct.
But the exception to this is those neurons that recur down to the subcortical nucleus.
Correct.
Is that right? So you bisynaptic activation in those.
Yeah. First, let me make sure that we don't have this misunderstanding that I notice it happens very often if I give this talk. There is no such a thing like lack of propagation of the electrical signal if you don't involve these particular microcircuits that I mentioned for cortex. We know, for example, if you stimulate the motor cortex, you're going to get movements. So it's not a big deal, and this goes over several synapses. If you stimulate the frontal areas, you're going to get eye movements, and you can get very precise results. There is absolutely no problem with that. The problem, the very specific problem, might be also an interesting problem because it forces actually to think of our results in a different way, is what is going to happen if you do a stimulation, and this stimulation assumes that it's going to be a cortical propagation of the signal, or you stimulate the afferents of cortex, say the thalamus, and you expect this to go to cortex through the normal way going to primary visual cortex, second area, third area, fourth area, whatever. There you have the problem. Now, the deep neurons, we knew that they are much faster and not much affected by the whole, basically, recurrent circuitry in cortex. There are experiments already 20, 25 years ago by Peter Hoffman, who actually noticed already then that this is one way for him to explain his results of microstimulation in both, actually, the LGN and in the colliculus. So we know that these paths, they are very fast, and they can work despite of the fact that the whole system, the normal, let's say, cortical output to the other cortical areas from the supraganglionic layers is either inhibited or completely shut down. So why it is so, of course, I don't know. I have no clue, not only I don't know. Yeah.
So you get functional activation of multiple thalamus by just reducing GABA?
Yeah. That's what we did in the end, right?
Right. But, I mean, if you want to look at cortical propagation...
I'm not sure if I understand your question. So would you just repeat it louder?
Sure. I mean, so you have the subcortical connection which allows you to go forward.
Yes.
And if you were able to eliminate the GABAergic circuitry here,
mm-hmm.
then presumably you're going to be able to look at multiple levels of propagation, right?
That's correct. I suppose it's going to go to the next station. I suspect, I didn't have time to tell you, if you stimulate cells instead of axons, you have less of a problem. For example, if you stimulate somehow the retina and the signal goes to LGN, and the signal that comes to LGN is not this simultaneous shock, then you may see propagation of the signal, and that's what we see if we stimulate the optic tract. But if you stimulate simultaneously the afferents of a cortical area, which is not so unusual, actually, we do it all the time. There are many studies of good colleagues that have been studying the effects of stimulation in perception. They stimulate a particular cortical area, and they assume that, to some extent, the chain of area X, X plus 1, X plus 2, X plus 3, works normally. And what I'm telling you, that particular sequence probably does not work normally. If you break the inhibition in one area and you let one area more naturally to spike, then probably you'll get normal propagation. But of course, it's a worthless kind of stimulation because if it were to be applied anywhere, you don't want to deal with drugs every time you try to stimulate. So that's why we spend quite a bit of time to try to break the synchronicity. But it is almost technically impossible to generate different distributions of charge densities over time that are different enough not to stimulate every single element that goes to the same position. So it's a very difficult problem.
Could you say a few words about research then that's going on in neuroaesthetic developed devices for people?
To be quite honest, I'm not the person to ask. I'm not a very big specialist. There are a couple of issues. The one is epistemological, philosophical, and the other is actually technical. The epistemological, philosophical, what I think is not okay, is that people pretend that, some people, not everybody, pretend that they say something profound about brain function by using prosthetic devices or by somehow finding the appropriate decoding mechanism for cell responses. You can develop very elaborate mechanisms to tell condition A from condition B by looking at very complicated spike trains. That does not mean you understand what the brain is trying to do. You have numbers, and the statistical pattern recognition is a technique that has been around for I don't know how many years, before I was born, and you can use all this technology. And my suggestion, in all modesty, is that we should not be getting too excited about the technology and think that we are saying something profound. We use the technology and we have a much more sensitive way to say situation A from situation B. So what I think is not very okay with the neuroprosthetics in some specific cases, whatever these cases may be, is that they pretend to say something fundamental. They do not. Actually, what they say is, I have a way to say that if I measure these spike trains, probably the animal looks at the right or looks down or looks up. It does not say that you can reproduce that, and it does not say that you understand the complexity of the local circuit. That's a more epistemological issue. Now, as far as the usefulness of this device is concerned, there I would be only positive, because for me it doesn't matter whether you understand the science or not. If your developments and your technology, together with the hardware, software, analysis, theory, everything, is good enough to improve certain situations and apply it for medical problems, I think you should do it. So these are two different issues. Only don't tell me you know how the brain works, because that's annoying. I don't think we do. So that's basically the story. You wanted to ask him. Yes, 1 second. Yeah.
But what about the spatial localization? Would that be better with bipolar electrodes? And if that's the case, couldn't you then use bipolar electrodes in the LGM, maybe to more specifically stimulate certain fibers?
Well, the quick, cheesy answer is actually try both, and it didn't make much of a difference, except that it makes your life difficult because you cannot really cause much of activation with the bipolar electrodes. The more serious answer is, the problem of bipolar electrode, or the benefit, it was never meant to be the spatial specificity. You can get excellent spatial specificity by generating what people call asymmetric impedance electrodes. If your electrode with respect to the ground has a very, very, very large difference in area, in surface area, then all the current is concentrated in one particular location. You know even which lamina you're activating, and the return lines are spread over a relatively large ground. And that permits excellent localization, does not require any bipolar electrodes. The bipolar electrode is only good because unquestionably it reduces enormously the shock artifacts. It's a very local current. And with this local current, basically, you don't see in the visual cortex. If you do in V1, if you do in LGN, the stimulation, and you measure electrophysiologically in V1, the artifact is almost one-tenth of a spike produced by the area. Beyond that, I don't think there is 1 second, because I think your colleague.
During a natural visual stimuli, you get propagation.
Correct. It's a very good question. In fact, actually, this is what I said, but everything said is so quickly it doesn't always make sense. If you want this cortical microcircuit, it's after Earth, it's not what I did. You know, it's been there, and that's the way it is. So there's not, if you want this thing to work properly, you cannot violate all this principle of synaptic delays. And you cannot violate also the very simple, reasonable fact that never, ever in normal life you have activation in a particular location of every single element. You simply don't have it. There are antagonistic relationships, there are receptive fields, there are inhibitory and excitatory regions. If you have a normal stimulus, whether it is through the skin or through the eye or through the nose, you have a spatial organization that acts on the stimuli. In the retina, we know it differentiates the signal spatially. It does different other things. And what you get up with your 1 million is something that is organized in space and organized in time. what we do with this electrical microstimulation, this zapping, and we should be aware of it because I don't think it's hopeless, but needs to be improved, is we violate both spatial and the temporal, basically, asynchronous, and we give a shock, and then we expect with this shock to have normal processing. And I can claim that much, that this is not possible. Everything is possible, but this particular thing is not possible. You're not going to tell me that cortex is going to obey this completely unnatural activation condition.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Tim Gaughan and I, when we recorded pairs of cells a long time ago, realized that adjacent cells were nearly adjacent as we could record them, were nearly independent, which was a result that the field didn't care for very much.
Yeah.
But it is exactly in line with what you're saying, which is that the normal circumstance in cortex is that cells are relatively independent.
Absolutely.
And they each play some role.
So absolutely.
The correlated signal is actually a small proportion of the information that they carry and transmit.
I couldn't agree more, but in fact, you know, in studies also from our lab and from other labs, they show that if you isolate the neurons 100% with tetrodes and you do your best and you do all classifiers, pattern classifiers, you select the isolated neurons, blah, 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 the correlation coefficient for spontaneous activity or stimulus-induced activity in neurons that are only 20 micrometers apart are extremely low. That means that circuitry, we say to the next student, the column does the same thing. Well, yeah, okay, good. The column is orientation column and represents its orientation, no question about it. But giving the impression to someone, every single little neuron, whether it is an interneuron, excitatory, inhibitory, pyramidal, small or large, or Sandeyer cell, it's going to be doing exactly the same thing and obeying basically the selectivity you see at the macro level. I think it's not just deceiving, it's gradually stupid, and we should stop it. Yeah, please.
You should go at the beginning that different types of neurons have different response timings, so you can simulate different timings of the electricity. So would it theoretically be possible to devise a signal that just specifically stimulates the activating but not the inhibiting neurons?
Yeah, you won't believe it, but somehow we had an overlap of ideas there. And we tried things like that, but I think what you do is you probably solve one problem, but you have another still. There's a spatiotemporal problem. It's very hard. We did what you say. We even actually recorded activity in an area and replayed this activity by changing the intensity of the signal to see whether some kind of normal stimulation that is coming from the LGN, after all, would that excite the V1 in a way that the signal will propagate? And the answer is definitely no. The moment basically you zap the system and you have this spatial homogeneity, the whole circuitry breaks down. Anyway, I'm not ready to start crying, to be honest, and I'm not trying to get you depressed. That's not the idea here, and I think basically electrostimulation can be immensely useful, and it's been useful, and it will be even more useful if it's used correctly. But as with methodologies and as with many other things, I think one realistically has to see what can be really done and what it cannot be done. And if there are ways, basically, to improve things, you can improve it. Otherwise, you use the methodology only in the cases you know unequivocally you're going to get a decent, replicable result, and this result is going to be for the reasons. You know very well that people they have the deep brain stimulation, and it's supposed to cure you for a lot of things. And every time it works, it's a magic. Every time it doesn't work, the surgeon was bad. And that's not true. It's totally not true. It depends on the location of the electrodes, the currents that you pass, the protocols that you are using. They make you very susceptible to all these small changes. Someone wanted and then...
Indeed, it was the same notion that in the motor system that you used as an example earlier, there was a very critical timing issue in terms of driving the cortical motor neuronal pathway. And indeed, there's lots of evidence in the old literature about shutting down pathways with high frequency stimulation. Certainly, it's a whole world of pulse trains. And you were using primarily 100 hertz, which
not only though. As you saw, I didn't have the chance. In the beginning, when I noticed it, I was so suspicious that I'm doing something genuinely stupid. I'm very serious about it, that I tried every imaginable combination of time, space, electrodes, multiple tips, one tip, different types, trying to understand, because if someone worked, I would say, okay, this condition worked. Why would that work? If that works, it means all the rest was wrong. But actually, the frequency is not... What the frequency does has an interesting effect. I did not have the time here, and I was almost suspecting it. I did not tell you anything about Bolt. These studies have enormous implications for Bolt, and we have now also the physiology and the microstimulation with the alert monkey, and there we have also the saturation effects that you can cause with microstimulation. If you increase the frequency by 200, 250 hertz, you have a complete saturation. You can put 3 million hertz if you want. You're not going to change the activation. So there are certain things, basically, that probably obey the rules of membrane constants and refractory periods in the system and different types of neurons involved, and unfortunately, we can only talk informally sometimes in the future.
One last question from...
I cannot hear you.
Is it technically possible to do near collision experiments? Let's say you stimulate the LGN and you give a little amount of time and you stimulate the ulcinol, and this will kind of help you distinguish between this cortical subcortical circuit?
I assume it is, but, I'm sure it is, but I would not immediately tell you right now that I know how to do it. I'm also sure that if I try to do it, I'm going to do another 3 million mistakes, and it's another 2 years, and I have to think of my retirement plan.